Portland is an extremely queer-friendly city, extremely trans-friendly, extremely non-binary-friendly, and I run with a group of mostly queer people, lots of non-binary people, lots of binary trans people, and we were having these really interesting conversations about gender. And I realized when I was at this conference that the majority of people in the majority of parts of the country aren't having those conversations. They don't have access to those conversations. They're not thinking really hard about gender all the time. And because of that, there's this huge knowledge gap. There's a really good meme, and it says something like, talking to trans people about gender, and there's an image of like philosophers, ancient philosophers talking, and then it says like talking to straight cis people about gender, and it's like a child playing with blocks. And like that's sort of the point we were at, is like there's this huge gap. And I think that there's so many straight cis folks who want to learn about gender, but they are so scared of messing up.
That was Molly Woodstock, and you're listening to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette, episode 127. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette. That's me, the podcast that's filled with refreshingly honest conversations about the wonderful mess of being human. I can't tell you how glad I am that you're listening in today. And I want to take a minute right here at the top of the show to quickly share some appreciation, give out a little thank you. Thank you for listening to this show. I know there's tons of podcasts out there. Thank you for valuing honest conversations. Thank you for being open to hearing from guests whose lived experiences and opinions might be different from your own. That's huge, and that's what we do here. And thanks for the more tangible stuff as well, for taking 2 minutes or less probably to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening from. Seriously, it's just a huge help in spreading the word and helping new people find us. So I really appreciate you taking a second to do that. And thank you so much for supporting and funding the show on Patreon. This is truly a community-funded podcast now, which means that we have complete freedom to come together with more honesty than ever before, and I am so grateful for that. I have a really wonderful guest to introduce you to today, but first, in case you're new to this show, I'd love to quickly explain what it is that we do here. So at the heart of it, my guests and I are really committed to one simple but powerful thing: telling the truth about our lives. No one's here to sell you anything. No one's trying to get you to fix yourself or your life. I certainly don't have any magic bullet 10-day, 6-step life hack plans for anything. As a recovering self-help junkie myself, I am totally over that approach. And my guess is that maybe you are too. Maybe that's even what brought you here. So no, that's not what this show's about. Here at Real Talk Radio, I sit down with athletes, writers, entrepreneurs, parents, coaches, adventurers, artists, activists, and tons of others, and we dive deep into meaningful topics. We talk about work, love, sex, money, addiction, friendship, racism, body image, mental health, grief, fear, courage, change, and everything in between. It's definitely an adult podcast that covers adult subjects, which means that we do often use adult language. So there's your little language warning. And we never shy away from telling the unfiltered truth in an open and honest way, even when it's uncomfortable. And sometimes it is. So with this mission in mind, you won't hear any ads or sponsor promotions. These honest conversations are 100% listener funded, made possible by awesome regular people like you who give $8 or more per 8-episode season. The show is and always will be free, but if you love it, if these conversations make you laugh, think, or just feel less alone, I hope you'll go to patreon.com/Nicole Antoinette to make your pledge of $8 or more per 8-episode season. You've probably heard me say this before, but I really do believe that where we spend our money, how we spend our money, that's a real-time vote for the kind of world that we want to live in. And when you help fund this show, you're voting for a world of honest, judgment-free conversations. You're voting to hear more stories from a wide-ranging group of people, the vast majority of whom are women. So when you support this show, you're saying loudly and proudly that women's voices deserve to be heard, and that no topic should be off limits due to fear or shame. This is a show by truth tellers for truth tellers. And as a thank you for supporting the show, you'll get access to over 40 hours of bonus content, as well as our monthly book club, which is super fun, my weekly behind-the-scenes email series where I share my real life in real time. It's probably, I mean, I'm vulnerable on the show for sure, but the weekly emails are where I share a lot of my real life as it's happening. And you'll also be the first to know when tickets go on sale for Real Talk Live events and other upcoming events in the future. There are 3 different funding levels that you can see over on Patreon. There's an $8 level, a $16 level, and a $25 level, each with their own unique, awesome bonuses. Everything that I just mentioned is at the $8 level. Up at the $25 level, we do live group Google Hangouts. And oh my gosh, those are so much fun. But again, you can check all that out over on Patreon. So one more time, it's patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette. And at the very end of this episode, you'll actually get to meet one of our Patreon community members who joins me for a fun little rapid fire question round. So stick around for that after the main episode for sure. And now, let's dive right into today's episode. Today, you'll get to meet Molly Woodstock. Molly is a queer, genderqueer, mixed-race, vegan journalist who lives in Portland with a cat named after nutritional yeast. Isn't that the best? A native Oregonian, Molly writes and edits articles for Travel Portland and Portland Monthly Magazine, and they also produce and host Gender Reveal, a podcast that centers non-binary and trans voices. In this episode, Molly gives us a mini crash course in Gender 101. What is gender? What are some of the myths and misconceptions about it? Where is our social conditioning about gender holding us back from seeing and respecting everyone on every point of the gender spectrum? We dig into that and a ton more. As a self-described white-passing mixed person, cis-passing non-binary person, and gay-ish person with a male partner, Molly talks candidly about their experience of living between the binaries. We also dig into a conversation about asexuality and how it, like gender, is also a spectrum. I'm really grateful for Molly's insights and stories about this, since it seems like asexuality is a sexual identity that's often really misunderstood, if not completely erased from public discussions about sex and sexuality. This conversation overall was just so honest and important, and I really hope that you enjoy getting to know Molly as much as I did. So all of that starts in just a moment, and as always, you'll be able to find all the links and resources mentioned in this episode over in the show notes at NicoleAntoinette.com/podcast. All right, let's do this. Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
I said this to you before we started recording, but I've been listening to so much of your podcast lately that it feels like kind of surreal to be like, okay, now we actually get to have a conversation in which I can say stuff too.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's always fun to have what feels like a crossover episode. I know it's just you interviewing me, but anytime two podcasters are talking to each other, it feels like a cool crossover episode to me. So
I know, excited. I always feel the same way. It's interesting. Since starting a podcast, I have become even extra flattered when other people ask me to be on their show.
And totally.
It's like someone's inviting you like into their living room to meet their friends. And it's like the nicest thing. And then when other podcasters say yes to me, then there's always, I don't know, obviously I love all my guests, you know, like love all your children equally, but it's always special to have other podcasters. So yay.
Yay.
Tell me something that you are totally obsessed with right now.
Oh gosh. I just finished the balance arc of a podcast that's called The Adventure Zone. And when I talk about The Adventure Zone, I always want to qualify that it's really funny that I'm into it because it's a podcast made by four cis straight white men, which I would never, ever, ever, ever expect to be interested in. And it's a Dungeons and Dragons podcast, which I would never, ever, 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 ever expect to be interested in. But The Adventure Zone, it took 3 years to do this one long story arc. And I started listening to it around Christmas. And it became a sort of safe space for me because I realized that one thing that's cool about four straight cis white men making content is that they don't really have any problems. And so I don't have to worry about the real world spilling in to this fantasy land made by white men because they just get to have like a fun, cool time. And so I'm subscribed to like 70 podcasts and most of them are social justice podcasts. Most of them are news podcasts and they're dealing with really, really heavy issues. And it got to the point where like I would wake up in the morning and I'd want to listen to the podcast, but they all felt so heavy and I wasn't ready to wake up in the morning and immediately like carry this huge heavy weight of all of the different social justice problems that we're facing in the world and all of the different news stories that we're working with. So instead I retreated into this like really fun, wacky, a fantasy land of a Dungeons and Dragons podcast. And it was great. And it made me realize that I think I envy folks who dive into escapism. And I had always seen myself as like, no, I don't have time for escapism. I need to work on the real problems of the world. And it made me really understand escapism as self-care and like letting yourself go into a world that doesn't have these problems is really fine and good and healing as long as you come back out ready to fight and ready to work. So that was a long answer, but yeah, I was really enjoying the balance arc of the Adventure Zone. There's also my favorite character in the show is a trans woman. And so there's lots of good representation, even though it was made by cis white men. Like, there's lots of really cool representation. The majority of the characters are queer, which I love. So, yeah, it's possible to find cool, queer, trans, racially diverse content that allows you to escape the horrors of the real world for a minute and then come back out and feel stronger. And that's what I've been obsessed with.
I have no idea what I was expecting you to say. That's such a good answer. I love this idea of sort of intentional escapism as self-care, because when you were describing that, I can relate to that a lot. Almost sort of like a guilt around escapism, or sort of like a moralizing, like, I'm too busy for that. I'm doing work that's too important for that. Like anything that falls into that space, which like is actually bullshit, and eventually you're going to burn out. And it's kind of why I started reading more kind of, I don't know, YA fantasy novel type thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I need things that are just for fun, like literally just for fun. And like you said, it's great when, you know, the cast or whatever, you know, can be less problematic and all of that. But doing something where you're like, literally the only purpose of this is like fun and recharging. And that's not just okay, but that's necessary.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. So we're going to talk about a lot of good things today, gender, sexuality, all of that good stuff. And just sort of like at the top, before we move into it, I wanted to give kind of like a quick disclaimer for folks listening. Like, A, I'm certainly not looking to you to be like the capital E expert on any of these subjects. I'm really delighted that you're happy to talk about your own experiences and talk about some of the topics that you do on your own podcast called Gender Reveal. But if I ask any questions that either you don't feel like answering or feel like unnecessary emotional labor, there's this phrase that I love. I don't know if you know who Leslie Mack is. She's a writer and activist. And I've heard her respond to people on Twitter just by saying, well, Google is free as fuck. So use that. So feel free, please, Molly, if any time the conversation goes somewhere where you're like, okay, Nicole, Google's free as fuck. Like, you can do this on your own. That's totally fine.
That sounds great.
Cool. I know, it's the best phrase. So I found you through our wonderful mutual friend and past podcast guest, Lacey Davis. Right around the time, actually, I think that you launched your new show. And I would love for you to tell me the origin story of why you decided to create that podcast.
That sounds good. I thought you were going to say the origin story of my and Lacey's friendship, which is also an excellent story. But yes, I can tell you about the relevant thing, which is my podcast. I had a previous podcast, which is called Smash Everything. And as of this recording, Smash Everything is still alive in iTunes, and Smash Everything was more of a broad overview of social justice topics. Every week we picked a different topic and we smashed it. So there were a lot of gender related topics, a lot of sexuality related topics, but there were also things like fat phobia, or our first topic was last names and how people choose whether to keep their last name when they get married, whether to change their last name either when they get married or just another point in their life. And it was fun. I had a good time making it, but it was really amateurish. I just picked up a Zoom recorder that I already had in my house and like wrestled my roommate at the time into recording our thoughts together. And it just wasn't really well produced. It was just a fun thing that I was doing with a friend. And over time, it sort of became less fun and more stressful. And I had been thinking about wrapping it up because I was sort of out of topics that I wanted to smash, or out of topics that I felt qualified to talk about, because I wasn't inviting a ton of guests on. It was mostly just me and my thoughts, and I don't know everything. So with that in mind, I went to a podcasting conference in Los Angeles last October, and it was a podcast that was called a women's podcasting conference. Women's podcasting conference. It was not a podcast. It was a podcasting conference. So I went to this women's podcasting conference, and they had said on their website that they explicitly welcomed non-binary folks as well as women. And as a non-binary person, I thought, that's cool. They seem like they're aware of non-binary gender, and they're going to accommodate and welcome non-binary people. So I will go to this women's conference because I was also explicitly invited. And I got there, and if there's any queer folks listening to this, they're probably used to walking into a room and immediately looking around for all the other queer people. And so I got to the conference and I started looking around for all the other queer people, and I could find like four of them in this conference of hundreds and hundreds of people. And not only could I only find like four queer people, and I'm sure there were more queer people, but I could only find like four, and I could find no other people who didn't identify as women. There was a 3-day conference. I never found anyone else who didn't identify as a woman. And the more I talked to people at the conference, the more I realized that the really high level conversations I was having about gender and queerness, both on Smash Everything, my last podcast, and just with my friends in Portland. Portland is an extremely queer-friendly city, extremely trans-friendly, extremely non-binary friendly. And I run with a group of mostly queer people, lots of non-binary people, lots of binary trans people, and we were having these really interesting conversations about gender. And I realized when I was at this conference that the majority of people in the majority of parts of the country aren't having those conversations. They don't have access to those conversations. They're not thinking really hard about gender all the time. And because of that, there's this huge knowledge gap. There's a really good meme, and it says something like, talking to trans people about gender, and there's an image of like philosophers, ancient philosophers talking, and then it says like talking to straight cis people about gender, and it's like a child playing with blocks. And like, that's sort of the point we were at. It's like there's that's this amazing. Huge gap. And I think that there's so many straight cis folks who want to learn about gender, but they are so scared of messing up that they don't even engage. Like, they're so scared of being a burden or of appearing ignorant that they just never start the conversation. Or maybe they don't know who to talk to or where to access those resources because all of their friends are straight and cis. And so there's just this huge gap. And the more I was at that conference, the more I was walking around saying, hey, what queer podcasts do you know? What podcasts do you know that talk about gender? And I couldn't find any. Like, there weren't really anything that existed that was like that. There's a podcast called Query by Cameron Esposito, which is the closest thing that I found to my podcast. And there's a podcast called Nancy, which is the queer podcast from WNYC, which has nothing to do with this. But those were like the only two queer podcasts that people could even name. And I was like, great, there's this huge vacuum. There's 400,000 podcasts out there, but none of them are talking about gender that I can find. And so, and you know, of course, later I found out that there are some tiny, really good podcasts by trans people talking about gender. So I'm not claiming I'm literally the only podcast that talks about gender, but at this big podcasting conference, none of us knew any gender podcasts. So I went home and I started working on a gender podcast, and I decided that this one was going to be the podcast that I took all of the tools and all of the things that I had learned from my previous podcast and made it just way better and something that I could be really proud of. And so, like, I contacted Breakmaster Cylinder to do my theme song, which was really cool for me. Breakmaster Cylinder is the person who did the Reply All theme song, a bunch of other stuff. And, like, I got a real logo made, and I bought, like, real equipment, and I worked with my friend who's worked at NPR to develop the podcast and make it like a real thing that people might actually want to listen to. And now it's a thing and it exists. So.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. Like I said, can you talk about your decision for the name of the show?
Yeah. I think I had one other idea for a name, which was, I think, they or them. And then that there's a new LGBTQ publication by the folks at Teen Vogue that's called Them, that came out while I was in pre-production. And I was like, that's great, because that was actually a terrible name, so I'm glad that someone else took it so I didn't use it. And then I think Gender Reveal was just the second name that I came up with, and it's obviously a play on the binary events that people hold when they're pregnant and they want to announce the supposed biological sex of the baby. They will have this big gender reveal party, where they cut a cake and it's blue or pink or, you know, whatever. There's a balloon. There's, I don't know, people do the wackiest, weirdest gender reveals. Sometimes they combine all the things I hate into one. Like, it's, like, hunting themed and they, like, shoot a gun and it's either blue or pink. And I'm like, what's happening here? But anyway, the whole point is, like, you can't find out your baby's gender from an ultrasound. You can find out the biological sex that they're going to be assigned, but you can't know their internal gender. You don't know that yet. And so for that reason, lots of queer and trans folks are pushing back against gender reveals and pushing back against assuming that you'll know your baby's gender. And more than that, like, so many gender reveals rely so strongly on, like, really, really strong gender and sex stereotypes. Like, if it's a boy, it's blue, and if it's a girl, it's pink, and if it's a boy, we're going to buy them footballs, and if it's a girl, we're going to buy them little dolls and whatever. And so just pushing back against all of that, like, really strong gender roles and sex stereotyping. So I decided, what would be more confusing than naming my show Gender Reveal?
So, no, I love it. It's, well, I mean, and having gender in the title too, like, it's pretty clear, yeah, right away that this is going to be the main subject of the show.
Yeah. And, like, the tagline when I introduce the show every week is, welcome to Gender Reveal, a podcast where we ask intrusive personal questions and hopefully get a little bit closer to understanding what the hell gender is. And so it really is, like, intending to be every week, like, these tiny reveals of how individual people experience gender. Because I think that was one of the biggest things I wanted to emphasize with the show, is that gender isn't a monolith. Not only is it not a binary, but people who identify as non-binary all experience gender in different ways, and people who identify as women experience that in different ways, and people who identify as men experience that in different ways. So I never want people to feel like they're giving the definitive answer of what it's like to be this kind of person. It's just like, this is how I, an individual, experience gender. So every week, a new person reveals a little bit about gender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that. I love the acknowledgement right up front too, that sort of similarly to what I said to you, like, you're not asking for anyone to speak for anyone other than themselves. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think periodically throughout this conversation, I'm going to ask what might be seen as silly questions, but I feel like it's always better to ask and have things almost, like, over-clarified and over-defined than maybe for someone listening to, I don't know, feel like there's just question marks everywhere and then they can't follow the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, so absolutely. Before, and if you know the answer, there's a 15-second skip ahead. Like, you don't have to listen.
Yeah, right. So, and I know this is, like, the question you're trying to answer with your whole show, but so I'm not actually asking, like, what is gender, but sort of, because obviously you just, in your explanation about gender reveal parties, like, made the differentiation between gender and sex. So can you just kind of, like, go through terminology really quick before we get into some more stuff?
Yeah, definitely. So the difference between sex and gender is often questioned and misunderstood. Sex is the biological components that are used to assign a sex at birth. So what goes into your biological sex would be external genitalia, internal genitalia, chromosomes, hormones, all of those things. Doctors look at them when you're a tiny baby and they say, ah, this person seems to be a boy, or, oh, this person seems to be a girl. And that's your sex. That's your biological sex. It's all physical characteristics. Gender is much less tangible. It's really difficult to define, and it relates entirely to social and cultural norms, behaviors, and expectations. So while biological sex is fairly static, your gender will be different. The experience of gender will be different, not your gender. The experience of gender will be different in different cultures and at different points in time. And so the behaviors we expect from women, for example, would be different in America today versus America in 1950 versus the land that's known as America in 1550. And it would be different in Thailand, and it would be different in Australia, and it would be different in France. Like, the way that we think about gender and gender roles and gender expectations is different in all of those countries and all of those different places in time. Mm-hmm. So the reason that it's really, really hard to define gender is because it is always changing. It depends on what culture you're in. It depends on when you're there. It depends on the group of people you're hanging out with. And there's not one set of definitions. I do want to say really fast that while gender isn't binary, biological sex is also not binary, because 1% of all folks are born intersex, and there are also a ton of studies and research papers that say that even non-intersex people don't show identical biological sex traits. And so when we talk about gender not being a binary, we need to also talk about sex not being a binary, and actually we all just sort of have bodies and expressions. It's kind of nonsense to put them all into one of two camps.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I don't know that I'd actually ever heard that about sex not being non-binary either. But the gender thing is interesting. I was thinking about this like in a very sort of clunky manner this morning, knowing that we were going to have this conversation, of like trying to go back to maybe like my earliest memories of gender, or trying to like use language to explain like why it is that I feel female, right? And it just like felt like, first of all, kind of like a strange, or like I couldn't really come up with good language. And part of it made me realize that exactly what you just said, that it all for me feels like in relation to something, that it's like, I'm like measuring myself against what I'm shown being feminine is, or what it is to you. Like, here are the roles, and like, do I fit that or do I not fit that? And I was trying to imagine, okay, well, if those cultural markers were different, would I identify differently? And it was all just like, I'm like, oh yeah, that's why there's so much in here to talk about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Yeah. It's really, really hard. When the thing about gender is, if you don't ever think about it, it's really easy to tell someone your gender. The more you think about it, the harder it is to talk about. And so the more I do gender reveal, the more I'm like, gosh, I'm glad I'm the person asking the questions and not answering the questions, because it just becomes more and more and more of a mess. And again, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to start the show, is because some people are not thinking about gender at all, and some of them are thinking about it way too much.
Yeah. So. No, I hear that. So when it comes to gender, how do you identify?
Yeah. I use a few different words. I identify as non-binary, which is an umbrella term that includes any gender that isn't strictly male or strictly female. I'll identify as genderqueer, which is sort of a synonym for non-binary that was used more in, let's say, the early 2000s. I mean, I'm pretty gender fluid, so I don't use that word a lot, but like internally in my head, I identify as gender fluid. Really all of the words that mean not cis, I use. It's also, I think, important to point out that the word trans really means a gender other than the gender you were assigned at birth. And so by that definition, all non-binary people are trans. And there are individual non-binary people who choose not to identify as trans and who choose not to claim that label. And that's super valid. But in general, when we say trans, we are including non-binary people in that. And so I do identify as trans, as well as non-binary and genderqueer and all those other words. Really, any word you want.
Really just a lot of vocabulary to pick from.
Yeah, because that's the thing, is like, we as a society like are still trying to figure out what words we want to use. People use gender nonconforming as a synonym for non-binary, but really gender nonconforming just means you don't conform to your gender. So there are cis people who could be gender nonconforming, but yeah, I could be on that as well.
I'm also going to do the silly question thing. It's funny to ask you questions that I know answers to, but I'm just going to do that anyway. For anyone who hasn't heard the term cis before.
Yeah, so cisgender is the opposite of transgender. I don't know, opposite is a weird thing, but basically cisgender means you were assigned your gender and biological sex at birth. Let's say you were assigned female at birth, and you were like, yeah, I'm a girl. And then you live 100 years, and every day from the day you were born until the day you die, you identify as a woman. Then you're cisgender. It means that you were born a woman, you identified as a woman your whole life, and that was easy for you. You just got to be a woman. So yeah, basically it means you're not trans.
Okay, yeah. What do you think are some of the most common questions that people have about gender? Like maybe even ones that they're too afraid to ask. I know that you take listener questions into on your show. So I'm interested maybe what's come up like when you said that you identify that sort of knowledge gap, and that folks who are curious about this stuff like don't know where to go. Are there any common questions that you've heard?
I think a lot of the common questions I've sort of like tried to preempt already. Okay. like are trans people non-binary? What does non-binary mean? How can you not? I mean, one question is just like, what do you mean you're not a boy or a girl? And like, it's just to the point where like, I can't comprehend being stuck in the binary. Just at this point in my life, it's really hard for me to go back to thinking like, what do you mean? So it's really hard for me to answer that question.
Yeah.
You know how some people feel like boys and some people feel like girls? Some people don't. I don't know. I don't really know what to tell you. So that's a common question. There's a lot of questions about pronouns. There's a lot of questions about, well, how am I supposed to be a person in society if gender isn't binary or real or assumed? I think a lot of people get caught up because I'll say a lot of things like, don't gender strangers. If you don't know someone's gender, don't assume their gender because it could be hurtful. And so if you're meeting a stranger, try not to say sir or ma'am or ladies or whatever. And then people get really stressed out and they're like, how am I going to be polite if I can never say sir or ma'am? Or like, how am I going to speak in the world if I don't get to make these assumptions? And it's like, well, first of all, you don't have to know everyone's gender. If it's a stranger that is, you know, your barista, you don't need to know your barista's gender. It's not a big deal. If for some reason you feel like you do need to know your barista's gender, maybe you see them every single day and you want to make sure you gender them correctly, you can politely ask their pronouns and then you'll know. Or you can say, you know, like, is this terminology comfortable for you? And then you'll know. It's not a ban on, you can literally never say, for example, sir or ma'am again. It's just like, when you're meeting strangers and you don't know how they identify, don't take the risk of misgendering them because it's hurtful. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of questions about like how to live in a world where you're not offending people. I get a lot of questions about, yeah, just like what non-binary means and all the different terminology, like the difference between non-binary and genderqueer and gender fluid and agender and all of that. But for the most part, the questions that I get for Gender Reveal, the show, are really hyper specific.
Yeah.
Like 17 paragraphs long. And they're like, okay, what do I do? And I'm like, I don't know. it really ranges.
People can go listen to those episodes too, you know, like you do a great job of answering questions. So, you know, we will obviously include like links in the show notes and everything like that. But the reason that I ask that is because I think that so often when someone is confronting a topic that might be new to them or unfamiliar, and like you said, the intention is good, but the knowledge isn't there. And there's so much fear of making a mistake or being hurtful or then doing those things and then getting defensive and not handling it well, that I think that there's, that it's just helpful to even hear you run through sort of like those lists of questions, because anyone who might have that question is like, okay, cool, I'm not alone. We're never alone, yeah. Right? Like, if you have a question about literally anything, there's plenty of other people who also have that question. But I don't know, I just think that it's sometimes comforting to be like, well, yeah, if you've never been exposed to something or never really thought about it, of course you're not going to know the answers.
Totally. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, which sort of ties into the questions I was just talking about, right? Is like, people are like, how am I supposed to know what language to use? How am I supposed to know someone's gender? And it's like, well, you ask politely. That's how you know. And I found with cis people specifically, they're like so terrified to ask someone's pronoun. And they're like, oh, but what if they're offended that I asked their pronoun? And it's like, no. People are going to be offended if you misgender them. They are going to be so relieved that you asked their pronoun. And if it turns out that it's some cis person who's angry that you asked their pronoun, like, that's on them.
Yeah.
And you're just a cis person doing educational work on pronouns with another cis person, and that's awesome. You're being a good ally. Yeah. You know, so either you're being, you know, if you're asking someone's pronoun, either you're showing a trans or non-binary person that you see them, which is awesome, or you're talking to a cis person who knows what you mean and will tell them your pronoun, which is awesome, or you get to do some educational work. Like, there's not really a loss there, but people are just so scared to ask.
Yeah. In this sort of arena, and I guess using the pronouns is like a concrete way to talk about this, when there's like fear of making mistakes, I've been thinking lately, or sort of like a question that I've been asking myself is, whose comfort am I prioritizing?
Exactly.
Which is like maybe a strange question, but like to your point, like if the fear is, oh, what if I ask another cis person their pronouns and they, you know, for whatever reason, they get offended or they don't like that. Okay. Like, am I prioritizing their comfort over the comfort of a non-binary person? I don't know. Like, I think for me, that's been a helpful sort of question.
Totally. It's a really good question. And I think it's also an issue that a lot of trans folks internalize, because I came out as non-binary to my friends, my close friends, more than a year before I came out at work. And part of that is because I sort of resent the entire coming out process. But a lot of it was because I was prioritizing the comfort and convenience of my coworkers over my comfort and convenience. And I thought it would just be too much to ask for them to use they, them pronouns for me. I'm already the youngest one there. I'm already the vegan. I'm already the queer one. It is unreasonable for me to ask these nice, straight, cis, you know, middle-aged folks to use they, them pronouns for me. And that was absurd, but also like coming from a very real place of fear and insecurity and being told by the world that trans and non-binary people are inconvenient and don't need to be accommodated. I think it's really important to ask those questions, because the more that cis people can show that they are willing and able and happy and excited to accommodate trans folks, the more that trans folks can come out without being scared that they're going to be seen as a burden, as an inconvenience.
Mm-hmm. That's so well said. I'm curious, going back to that, you know, that you didn't come out for a year to the people at work. Was there any sort of internal personal resistance that you had to identifying as non-binary, not just about like specifically telling other people are coming out, but I'm curious like what that felt like internally for you.
Yeah, there was a huge, huge resistance. I have a very short essay coming out in Portland Monthly Magazine in May of 2018, where I talk about this a little bit, but basically, I have a friend named Z. They're my best friend in the world. And they were coming out as agender specifically at the time. And they were like, you know, I think that you say a lot of things that indicate to me that you might be non-binary also. So you might want to, you know, think about exploring that a little bit. And my first reaction was, I'm already queer and, you know, not a man and vegan, and I'm mixed race, so I have a lot of weird racial feelings, and really, like, and I'm like a lot of like chronic illness, and being cis was the only privilege I had left, which was a joke. Also not true. I have a lot of other privileges, but like at the time I was just like, being cis is the only thing I have left. Don't take this from me.
That's such an honest thing to say.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was really resistant, and I just kept, you know, bringing stuff up with them. And I'm like, well, I have always felt this way, and I do feel like this, but maybe I'm this, and I do feel this way, but most women probably feel this way, and I do feel this way, but blah, 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 blah. And finally, they were just like, Molly, the thing is, most cis women don't spend this much time thinking about whether or not they're cis women. Like, they just know. Like, if you probably, if you're thinking about it this hard, you're probably some kind of non-binary. And I was like, I don't know. And, you know, it was one of those things where, like, I had to think about it for months and months and months to be comfortable with it. But the reality was that when I saw other non-binary people out in the world, I felt really jealous. And I was like, how come they get to do that and I don't get to do that? And finally, I just had to be honest with myself and be like, you can do that. You just have to, like, assert yourself and tell people in the world that that's how you want to be addressed and treated. And I have to say that being non-binary is really hard and shitty, because the world doesn't see you and doesn't respect you. But ever since I came out, both to my friends and at work, I've gotten to spend the majority of my time in spaces where I am seen and respected. And it feels really, really incredible. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. It's really hard. I love being queer and I wouldn't trade it for anything. Being non-binary, I still, like, I don't love it. if I could change it, like, I would think I might. I don't know. But it got to the point where the question for me wasn't, like, am I non-binary or am I a cis woman? The question was, like, am I going to be open about the fact that I'm non-binary, or am I going to stay closeted and try to conform to cis womanhood?
Mm-hmm.
And so the answer seems sort of obvious that, like, maybe you should identify as the person you actually are.
Yeah, but I think that, I mean, obviously everything that you're sharing is so honest and I'm so grateful for it. I think that it's helpful, though, to talk about this kind of stuff because it's not always as clear cut. You know, it sounds like a really great story to be like, well, and this is the way I feel. And so then I just started identifying this way. And like, and maybe that is true for other folks, but hearing that it's a struggle and hearing the reasons, you know, why it might have felt safer not to, like, this, I feel like these are the, this is like the type of honesty that's necessary.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, it's weird. It's weird being non-binary because at least for me, I can point to a lot of ways that I'm not comfortable with the roles and expectations of being a woman. And there's this little part in my, a little part, a voice in my head that comes from trolls on the internet that says, like, well, there are a lot of cis women who don't conform to those specific things. So what's the difference between being like a cis woman who doesn't conform to those specific attributes and being non-binary? Maybe you're just like whining a lot about like trying to be special. Maybe you're just like trying to be a cool special snowflake. And this is what every woman goes through. And you're just making a bigger deal out of it than most people. And like those voices are real because we're told that every day by people who don't believe that non-binary people are real.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like as soon as I get in a space where I am like seen and respected and validated and loved, like all of those questions go away and I feel so good and I feel so seen and I feel so comfortable. So like those voices aren't right. They're not correct, but they're still in my brain a lot of the time because that's still like the message that I get from the world. So I love and respect all of my non-binary friends and family. I'm so in awe of the non-binary youth that are coming out in like high school. They're so cool and rad. I want them to like be my tiny, like guided. What would that be called? Like whatever, like, you know how they say like, you need to watch out and like support queer youth, but I want queer youth to support me because they're just so much smarter and cooler than I am. Yeah, like I love them and I respect them so much, but I also love and respect the people who get to this point and are like, I'm just gonna like stay in this box, in this binary gender box, because it's really hard to be out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never like try to drag anyone out of their comfort zone.
Yeah, totally. So other than things that you've already mentioned, are there any other particular maybe, I don't know if misconceptions is the right word, but misconceptions you think that people have about non-binary folks that you wanted to kind of point out or call out?
Yeah, sure. I think that a lot of people see non-binary the same as being androgynous. In my specific case, I love androgyny. That's the gender that I feel comfortable in. I try to find clothes that folks of all genders could wear. But there are so many non-binary people who aren't androgynous. You can be transmasculine. You can be transfeminine. You can dress in a way that would be consistent with your assigned sex. So, like, let's say you were assigned female at birth and you're still presenting, like, really feminine, but you're non-binary. That's super allowed. And so I think it's important to recognize also that folks of all ages and all assigned genders and all sexualities and all sizes and all races and all cultures can all be non-binary. And actually, speaking of that, so many Indigenous cultures have non-binary genders. Like the concept of a really strict binary gender is actually often a product of colonization. Like, especially in America, the classic example is Two-Spirit, but there are more than 500 Native American tribal nations in this country. And so not all of them had like specifically a Two-Spirit person, but lots of different tribal nations had different concepts of gender, and a lot of them weren't necessarily binary. And if you look at cultures around the world, you look at Thailand, you look at India, you look at all these places, like, they had concepts of non-binary gender. And so just because, like, our Western, you know, colonialist society has decided that binary gender is the norm doesn't mean that it was always this way. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's two things, but, like, it can be anyone. And that's why it's so important to not assume anyone's gender, because I think that people are getting a little bit better at making sure they don't gender obviously queer, obviously androgynous people until they know what their gender is. But I think people are still comfortable making assumptions about people that present as, like, traditionally feminine or traditionally masculine. And I think it's important to always ask or, you know, or avoid it.
And also, I think that it's like, we don't realize how much of specifically this stuff, but other topics as well, like, things that we have been taught consciously and subconsciously, how hard it is to unlearn some of that stuff. Like, they're not gendering, misgendering strangers. I've been thinking about that a lot the last, like, year or so, and just how much it's just unconscious. Like, if I'm, like, you know, walking around and, like, I do it. I don't know if it's, like, the nature of, you know, we want things to make sense in the way that we think that they should. We like things to be in categories. We want to know. And I think that goes into much, like, other topics too. We like when things fit in boxes. And so it's like, oh, well, you know, this guy or this woman or this whatever. And it's, I'll have to sometimes catch myself and be like, you don't know that. And it's just like, it's like over and over again. I feel like it's like, this is probably a really weird analogy, but kind of like potty training a puppy or so. Okay. Well, then you, like, put it back on the mat and you put it back on the mat, that it's like one of these things that I know. So I just wanted to share that that's sort of been my experience, like, even as trying to be more aware of this, that it's still like, we can have this conversation and everything you're saying makes complete sense. And I think, okay, yeah, I definitely don't want to, you know, misgender someone or gender strangers or, you know, this kind of stuff. And yet it still happens all the time. And, like, just trying to keep, I don't know, realizing that.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I would like to share that I misgender people in my head all of the time.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, and I think I want to make sure people know that, because I think that some people are scared to make mistakes, and you're going to make mistakes. And one way to prevent making mistakes out loud is to think before you speak. I had a guest recently, Kirby Conrad. Everyone really loved that episode. It's episode 13. And they're a sociolinguist and syntactician, and they talked a lot about pronouns because that's what they study. And, like, one of the big things they recommend is, like, if you're having trouble with pronouns, literally just slow down when you're talking, because, like I said, I misgender people in my head all the time, and I just catch it before it comes out of my mouth. Mm-hmm. and so, yeah, like, maybe one day we're going to practice so much and we're going to put the puppy back on the mat so many times that we're not even going to misgender people in our heads. And that's awesome. But until then, let's try to just slow down and not misgender people out loud. And if we do, correct ourselves and move on. Because I think, you know, practicing correcting yourself is helpful not only for yourself, but for all of the people around you who are learning from you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it's sort of, there's a tie into learning any other language. You're still going to think in your primary language, and the slowing down is a really helpful tool. Yeah. Actually, so maybe we could talk, because obviously we talked about pronouns, but I'd love to talk a bit about just gendered language in general. And maybe if there's any examples that come to mind for you of language that you'd love for people to stop using. I've thought about this for myself, just in terms of, like, trying not to say, like, you guys as a catch-all term, which was surprisingly and still is, like, harder to break than I thought it was going to be. But is there anything in there that comes to mind that you wanted to talk about?
First of all, I want to say that I think every single person I know, which again is, like, mostly queer and trans people, everyone is still saying you guys, and we all feel bad about it, and we're all trying to stop, and none of us can stop. So, like, you're right along with everyone else there. I almost want to get, like, every single person to just, like, sign a form that's like, we've all decided that you guys is gender neutral because this is too much.
Yeah.
But I don't know that there's anything specific. Here's one thing. I was assigned female at birth. I'm read by strangers as a woman, so I don't experience this, but my best friend was assigned male at birth, and I realized that when we go out, so many people, strangers, are like, hey man, what's up man, hey man, okay man, here you go man, what's up bro, and, like, I didn't realize, because I've never considered a man, how often men are, and people who are perceived as men, are just constantly gendered out in the world, so, if that's something that your listeners are saying, maybe try to dial that back a bit because you don't actually know if they identify as men. Obviously, if you're calling any adult girls, like, I don't care if they do identify as women, like, maybe just don't call adult women girls. Like, that's gross and condescending. But in general, I think the key is just to think really hard about what you're actually trying to say. And that comes up a lot when we're talking about bodies. I was the editor of a health section of a magazine for a long time, and it got to a point where, you know, I was writing about uteruses a lot. I was writing about bodies that are traditionally considered female a lot. And the secret to that is really just thinking about what you're trying to say. So if you're trying to say the story is for people who menstruate, then maybe say the story is for people who menstruate instead of women, you know, like instead yeah. of women, you know, instead of you know, writing an IUD story about, like, this is for women who want IUDs. It's like, these are for people with uteruses, you know? And, like, I've heard that mocked a lot. there was, like, a really absurd This American Life story about Lacey Green who talked about this and was like, and then I called people with uteruses, and they were offended, and they were like, I don't want to be, you know, boiled down to just my uterus. I'm a person. But again, it comes back to, whose feelings are you prioritizing? Are you prioritizing the feeling of cis women who don't like being called people with periods or people who menstruate or people with uteruses? Or are you prioritizing the feelings of trans and non-binary people whom you're actually, like, seeing and including in that language?
I just to interject really quick. There's, and I'm going to blank on the name of the company, and hopefully you can fill it in. The one of the sponsors that you have for your show that's in this, it's in something in the menstruation space, right?
Oh, Bad Rags.
Okay, yeah. And that definitely caught my attention too, just in the way that you sort of talk about that company. And I don't remember the exact phrasing that you used, but it was something along the lines of, like, for people who menstruate or something like that. And obviously, if you listen to a lot of podcasts, you hear a lot of different ads. Sometimes you hear similar companies. I've heard other podcast hosts who have had ads that are related to any kind of, you know, product in that space. Mm-hmm. And the language you used is so different that it's like you said, like, this is for women or this, you know, and just like that tiny tweak, like, I knew exactly what you meant. And it was actually more, I don't know. I mean, I was going to say more correct, which is, I mean, I don't know. It's like, not
but it
great
is
English,
more accurate. Yeah, it's because, like, more accurate. There are so many women who don't menstruate, like, because we, you know, folks are on IUDs or they're on, like, pill cycling or they are, you know, menopausal or their little girl or whatever. But for some reason, like, there's lots of women who don't menstruate and there's lots of people who aren't women who do menstruate. So it just makes a lot more sense if you're selling period products to talk to people who menstruate than to talk to women, because it's really not the same. And, like, that's something that I admire about GladRags is GladRags is a company of menstruation products, and they also avoid gendered language. They do not sell their products to women. They sell their products to people who menstruate. And I think that's really incredible. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of them.
Yep. I think so too. I'm going to put a link for them in the show notes too.
Great.
And yeah, just like stuff like that. Like I, the thing that you said, that's really going to, I mean, you've said a lot of things already that are going to stick with me from this conversation, but on the language front of just being more clear on what you're actually trying to say, instead of, like, I think we've been taught to use, you know, gender binary categories as sort of catch-alls for things because, you know, we just culturally assume that being a man means X, Y, or Z, or being a woman mm-hmm. means, you know, this, that, or the other. And so then it's easy to just use that instead of the more specific, you know, people who menstruate, for example. And I think that that could be true in a lot of different situations, that if you just think a little bit more critically about what you're actually trying to say, that it can be, like, both more inclusive and more accurate.
Totally. And it comes up sometimes when people are trying to be inclusive, but they're not actually hearing the words that they say. So for example, I was listening to a very popular podcast, and they were talking about OBGYN visits, and they said something like, all women and people who identify as women will need to go to the OBGYN once a year. And it's like, no, what are you talking about? What does that mean? Are you saying that trans women need to go to the OBGYN once a year? Because there are a lot of trans women who still have penises and they don't need to do that. There's nothing for them to do there. What you meant was, like, everyone with, like, these specific parts, or, like, most women and also some non-women, you know, but, like, what you said sounded inclusive and didn't actually make any sense at all. So, I mean, that comes up a lot also with women and femmes. Women and femmes is a phrase that people have started using sort of for the appearance of being inclusive to non-binary femmes, but is really causing a lot of problems also because now we're just saying it. We're not really thinking about when it makes sense to say it. So, yeah. Think about what you're saying.
So sort of on this topic, but I guess like pivoting slightly, for you as a self-described white passing mixed person, cis passing non-binary person, and I know that you mentioned sort of off air having a male partner. Can you talk about your experience of living between like multiple binaries? I'm specifically interested in... how do I want to phrase this? The balance, even though balance is probably not the right word, of like privilege and like erasing or like erasure.
Totally. That's such a good question. Short answer is it sucks.
Short answer is burn it all down.
Yeah, totally. I mean, but I think like that is the reason why I am so resistant to binaries and so resistant to like trying to fit in specific cultural boxes is there's so many areas in which it's really hard for me to do that. And sort of like with the gender thing that we already talked about, I don't have a problem with my identity until I'm trying to fit it into the boxes that exist. And that's when I start to feel really bad about myself and really stressed out. And my life personally would be a lot easier if we stopped having to categorize people in one of two ways. But I do understand that the way our brains are made, we want to put everyone in boxes. Like, I get it, but it sucks. Yeah, it's hard. Another thing I alluded to earlier was that I feel like I check all of the alt boxes, but also in ways that are not the most extreme version. Let me try to say this. So like I could check a box that I'm a person of color because my mom is Indigenous. But I'm also extremely white passing. And I can check a box that I'm queer because I am. I'm super queer. But I have a cis white male partner, which gives me a lot of like privilege as well as erasure. And I could check a box that I'm trans, but as a, like it's very easy for me to be a trans person compared to trans women of color who are getting murdered. Like, I don't get worried often about being murdered for being trans the same way that like my friend who's a trans woman of color is actively worried about being murdered. And so it creates this weird space where I feel like I've sort of look like I'm special snowflaking myself because I could pass as a cis straight white woman and like that would be fine and no one would question it, and that's actually how I'm read most of the time. But I identify as none of those things. So it's hard. It's hard because like that isn't who I am. But it's how I'm perceived. And so I get a ton of privilege from the way that I'm perceived. And like you alluded to, I also am erased all of the time.
I mean, yeah, because the privileges are coming from how we're read.
Right. Exactly. And then there's also, you know, the constant question, which is again, a privilege, but there's a constant question of like, should I try to pass as this thing? Will it be more like socially advantageous if I continue to pass as this thing? Or is it better for me to be out as this other thing? And it's like sort of a, you know, it's hard because on the one hand, if I have privilege, I should be using the privilege to advocate for other people who don't have those privileges. I just wrote, I was asked to write for a magazine. I'm a journalist and I was asked to write for this magazine the other day. And I wrote back and was like, I looked at your magazine and there's no people of color in your magazine. There's no people of company color that write for your magazine. And there's no people of color who are acknowledged in the text of your magazine. Why would I write for your magazine? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And I had a few different Black women who talked to me afterwards and was like, I would like to write a message like that, but I can't because I'd be seen as an angry Black woman, right? And so like on one hand, it's like I need to use the privilege that I have as someone who's read as white to yell at people for, you know, being inclusive. But on the other hand, like I don't feel like I fit in groups for people of color. I don't feel like I fit in groups for white people. I don't feel like I fit in groups for trans people. I don't feel like I fit in groups for cis women. It's really, I don't, like, this feels so, I feel like I'm in, like, my, like, emo teen blog spot, but, like, I don't feel like I fit in anywhere. And that's why my best friend Z is so important to me, because they are non-binary and queer and vegan. They're white, but that, you know, whatever, you can't have everything. But it's so nice to have one person that makes me feel like I'm not an alien that's been dropped off on this planet. It's nice to have one person who makes me feel like seen and validated and like I'm not the only one. But for the most part, yeah, I do feel like I'm being left out of both sides all of the time. And I'm like walking this weird line where I like need to acknowledge my privilege, but I also don't want to erase myself. So I like refer to myself as white a lot because I have white privilege, but then I'm like, but also I'm not. Like, yeah. I'm not actually, but I am, but I'm not. It's really hard. And I would like to see us move away from making everyone like decide what team to be on, but not to say that it's like we should be colorblind and there should be no race and no gender, but like it's stressful as someone who lives in between all of them to feel like I need to pick a specific side, because I do feel like I'm either erasing myself or like encroaching a community in which I don't necessarily belong, or at least I'm, you know, I'm far from the most marginalized person in that group. So I shouldn't be taking up space, I think, is the thing. It's like, it's not that I can't be in the group, but I don't want to be taking up the most space in the group.
No, I think, I mean, obviously just like hearing you talk about your experience and like, this is what it's like for you, like that I think is incredibly powerful. And I'm just like, you can't see that I'm nodding along, but I'm like very grateful for your honesty. So thanks for that.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
Pivoting a little bit, one of the topics that you said that you wanted to talk about today is asexuality. And I'm, again, super grateful for that too, because I feel like, I mean, sex has been talked about on the show, sexuality has been talked about in different capacities, but I feel like this sexual identity in particular is often misunderstood, if again, like not completely erased from, you know, larger discussions about sex and sexuality. So I don't know, I'm like stoked that you want to talk about this.
Yeah, hell yeah. That's another thing I didn't even add to my list of of like worlds that I live between. But yeah, I would love, should I just like dive in and explain what it is?
Yeah, let's start there for sure. Yeah, what it is, and especially in the context, I think this is another term that people have a lot of misconceptions about, and especially like how it's portrayed culturally.
Yes, I am always so excited to talk about asexuality because it is very, very misunderstood. And every time I talk about it, people are always like, oh, I relate to that. I'm like, yeah, see, it's fine. It's relatable content. But asexuality is perceived, as I'm sure we all know, as the as people who are very frigid, they're very cold, they're very childlike and naive, maybe, and they have never had sex, they never want to have sex, they never will have sex, and they're very like, beep, boop, beep, boop, and that is not what it is. The asexuality spectrum, because it is a spectrum that runs from absolute total asexuality, which is maybe something like I just subscribed, like is repulsed by sex, would never want to have sex, will never have sex, all the way up to, I mean, a spectrum would go all the way up to the other end. So it'd be, I guess it'd be hypersexual people, like people who want to have sex all the time. And the whole, you can't see me, I'm gesturing wildly, but the whole, like, bottom half of the spectrum would be the asexuality spectrum. The same way that, you know, we can have a spectrum from gay to straight, and the whole left side would be the gay part of the spectrum. So, which is also problematic, let's not worry about that. Let's go back to asexuality. So
we can only cover so many problematic topics in one conversation.
Well, I didn't want to erase, like, all bisexual people. I was just like, well, so anyway, so going back to asexuality. Asexuality is a lack of sexual attraction, but you can be on the asexual spectrum and still experience sexual attraction in certain contexts. So there's demisexuality, which is a situation in which you only feel sexual attraction if you are emotionally connected to someone. So you don't feel sexual attraction to strangers. And the example I always use for this is a good sign that you might be asexual or demisexual is if you have a crush on a celebrity, let's say it's Beyonce, and you could have a fantasy about Beyonce in the safety of your own home, but once you, if you met Beyonce on the street and Beyonce said, let's have sex, you would say, no thank you Beyonce, I'm not actually comfortable with that, because Beyonce is a stranger and you haven't had a strong emotional connection to them. And so, that's demisexuality, asexuality. Gray asexuality is just the idea that you don't experience sexual attraction most of the time. Maybe in rare circumstances you do. Maybe there's one specific person you're sexually attracted to. Maybe it's like once a month every year. Maybe it's like once a day every month. I wouldn't expect it to be like that clockworky, although maybe it is if you're hormone cycling and like you have a specific time of your hormone cycle where you do feel sexual attraction. I don't know. I'm not going to tell you how to live. This whole group of people who are generally speaking not experiencing sexual attraction, at least not to strangers, is considered the asexuality spectrum. I also want to emphasize that sexual attraction and romantic attraction and aesthetic attraction are all totally different, and asexuality has nothing to do with romantic attraction. And so there's lots of asexual folks who will want to go on dates, want to cuddle, maybe they want to make out even, they just don't necessarily want to have sex with you. Although if they're demisexual, maybe once they feel strongly bonded to you, they will want to have sex with you. Or maybe if they're gray asexual, maybe at some random point they might want to. But it's not romantic attraction. It's not black and white. There's no gatekeeping. It's not like if you have sex this many times, you're not asexual. Most asexual people have had sex because our culture is obsessed with sex. So there's no rule that's like if you've had sex, you're not asexual, or if you've ever wanted to have sex for any reason, you're not asexual. It's just like this one end of the sexuality spectrum where you're not super interested in sex.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my silly question for this, or I guess I shouldn't call it that, like no question's a stupid question, but whatever. My silly question on this topic is the difference between sexual attraction and sexual desire, if there is one.
Sexual desire doesn't necessarily have to do with who exactly you're attracted to, would be how I would answer that. So like an important point that you sort of led me into is that you can be asexual and masturbate, and you can be asexual and fantasize. The real thing is that you're just not interested in having sex with other people. And so like you can still like watch porn. Some asexual people watch porn and some don't. Some masturbate, some don't. Some fantasize, some don't. And none of that invalidates asexuality. So like, just my personal answer would be you could be an asexual person who has a lot of sexual desire, but you feel really comfortable satisfying that by yourself in the comfort of your own home, and you don't see any need to include any specific person in it. Whereas sexual attraction is like, this is a specific person with whom I would like to have sex.
Yeah, that's such a good clarifying answer. I could have asked it better because I was thinking along the lines of masturbation when I was thinking about sexual desire. Yeah, cool, awesome. So again, just like asking for your sort of like personal identity. So is that how you identify as asexual?
Yeah, I really only talk about it in the context of education at this point, and okay, like maybe first dates. And the reason is that the more that I do sexual, I'm not saying that I won't share my story because I absolutely will, but I'm saying it mostly because like I try to preface, like if I go on dates with people, I'm like, just so you know, I'm asexual or on the asexuality spectrum, and here's my deal. And the more I do that, the more I realize that so many people are on the asexuality spectrum, which is why it's really important for me to talk about it. I think a lot of people are demisexual. I think a lot of people aren't comfortable having sex unless they like feel really emotionally connected to someone. And we just don't talk about that because our culture emphasizes like one night stands and like instant sexual attraction so much. And hookup culture also, right? Mm-hmm. We emphasize that so much that it's assumed that that's how everyone is. But the more I talk about it, the more that like I feel like so many people are demisexual. So the only reason that I've started like backed a little bit off identifying that way is I feel like it's almost misleading because then I'm seen as like this weird alien creature. And I'm like, no, everyone's like this. Not everyone, but you know, so many people are like this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my story is that I actually identified as asexual before I even identified as queer, which makes sense when you think about the fact that the reason I didn't think I was queer is because I didn't like look at women on the street and want to have sex with them. Granted, I actually didn't look at men on the street and want to have sex with them either, but I wasn't really thinking that far into it. I was just like, well, I don't look at women and immediately want to sleep with them, and so I can't possibly be queer. And then once I realized that I was asexual, it was a lot easier to feel out like, okay, well, if it was someone that I did feel safe and comfortable with, who would I be attracted to? And it turns out I'm like really gay, but I just like didn't really know. So I realized that I was asexual in college, and the first person I told was my friend Z, who was also very asexual, which is another reason why we're good friends, because they can talk me through all of my asexual dating stories and vice versa. But yeah, I've also been lucky enough to end up with partners who are on the asexual spectrum, which is great, and the way that I experience asexuality is that there are times when I'm interested in sex with a certain person and there's like a period of time in which that's interesting, and then it's just sort of like never interesting again. Like I'm just like, well, that's done forever. And I'm very lucky to have a partner who's fine with that. It was just like, great, we just never have to have sex again. Like that's chill. So I feel really lucky that that's how I've ended up with like friends and family who understand that. But it can be really, really hard when you don't end up with those friends or those relationships, and maybe you're an asexual spectrum person partnered with someone who is very interested in sex and who sees sex as like a very important part of a long-term relationship. And yeah, that can get dicey.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Trying to step back and think about it, as someone myself who is, I was just going to say very sexual. I don't know what on the spectrum is. Like trying to imagine being in what I feel like is a hypersexualized society and not aligning with that. I don't know. Like I'm trying to put myself in that position and I can't. Yeah. And I imagine that it's very hard.
It's just like confusing, I think, because like as someone who like does experience sexual attraction sometimes, I am familiar with like the weird lizard brain that takes over and it's just like sex, 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 and like I cannot imagine feeling that way like the majority of, or like, you know, like often, because mm-hmm. I just always feel like so weird and out of control, and I'm just like, oh, is this just how y'all feel all the time? Like that's so weird, no wonder like people use sex to sell everything, like this is absurd. But I also think part of that is being like someone who is not attracted to, you know, like not like I'm not a man. And so when I see like what's made for men to be attracted to, I wouldn't necessarily be attracted to that either. So that's another whole part of it. It's really weird and alienating. And it's just like, I don't really know why you did that thing. And it's like, oh, because like they wanted to have sex. So it's like, oh, okay. I guess that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. On the whole, how do you feel like people react when you tell them that you're asexual?
I don't tell a lot of people. I don't tell people unless I have time to give them this entire mini lecture.
Right.
That's what I'll say.
Just be like, here, listen to this 2-hour podcast.
Exactly. I don't like whip it out at parties. And it is interesting because I've actually had a couple of close friends recently, like including one like very close friend. And she was like, you know, I just feel like I'm not sexually attracted to people unless I have like a strong emotional connection to them. I'm like, yeah, demisexuality. And she was like, what? And I was like, I've made 4 podcasts about this. I thought we were friends and you didn't listen to any of my 4 podcasts. But that's why I want to keep talking about it, because there are still people who are experiencing it and don't know what it is. But yeah, I mean, people definitely think that I'm like a weird alien. And then I give them a 5-minute mini lecture, and then it switches from you're a weird alien who never wants to have sex to, oh, I relate to that also.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I mean,
or if I don't relate to it, then at least I can understand and it seems like a normal thing.
Definitely. And a manageable thing. Yeah, I think that's why, obviously people are welcome to whatever amount of privacy that they want, but like as much as someone is comfortable talking about whatever their experience of their different, you know, identities are, it's like gives other people, like you said, the maybe a different perspective, maybe the reassurance that they're not the only one. And even, you know, with that example you just gave of providing the terminology for a friend, like that words matter so much. And like before you have the right words and like terminology to explain any identity, I know like it just feels so much better when you're like, okay, like this is a thing, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's the thing is like you, someone doesn't necessarily need to publicly identify as asexual and like put it in all of their bios and tell everyone. But I think just the knowledge, like you said, the knowledge that there are other people out there who feel the way you do is really important, because I still remember when I first learned about asexuality, I was like, oh, I thought I was just broken. You know, like I wasn't broken. I was just like this different kind of person than these other type of people. And yeah, that's why I think it's so important. And I think especially it's never, ever, ever okay for people to pressure other people to have sex with them, obviously. But I think having the vocabulary of like, oh, maybe this is why I'm not sexually attracted to this person, or maybe this is why I don't want to have sex with this person, can help you assert yourself and mm-hmm. be like, I'm not interested in having sex. It's because I'm asexual. And that can like get you out of a situation where you feel like you need to say yes, even mm-hmm. though obviously you never need to say yes. But, you know, just like realistically, it is easier to have a vocabulary to talk about it.
Yeah, totally. No, I think that's really well said. So sort of changing topics entirely, you mentioned a couple times being vegan. And one of the things that you said when we were deciding what to talk about on the show, you said, I can talk about how to be a chill vegan versus a very problematic vegan. Like laughing so much when I was reading that, because that resonated like so much. So yes, like let's definitely go there. I don't know, you know, in which specific direction you wanted to take that, but I would love to kind of maybe start with how you see veganism as being problematic, like sort of what that space looks like.
Yeah, I mean, it ties very much into something I was talking about a little bit ago, which was that magazine that I was asked to write for that was all white. That was it was a plant-based wellness magazine, and it talked a lot about like meditation and turmeric and superfood smoothies and mindfulness. And at no point did it acknowledge that that had been developed over millennia by people of color. So that was weird and bad. But just in general, there are many reasons that people might be vegan. And in many of these contexts, people can go vegan without ever really being exposed to other social justice frameworks. And that doesn't make them like a bad vegan or less vegan, but it can make them a very, very single issue vegan. And there are a lot of people who seem to be concerned about non-vegan animals more than they are concerned about, non-human animals. People who are concerned about non-human animals more than they are concerned about humans. And indeed, there's actually a surgence of vegetarianism and veganism within white supremacist organizations. You can go all the way back to the fact that, like, Hitler was a vegetarian. That's famous. But, like, even today, there are folks who are KKK members who are also, like, very strong vegans. So you can't make the assumption that just because someone is aware of oppression when it comes to cows and chickens and sheep and whatnot, they are also aware of oppression when it comes to racial injustice or other forms of injustice. I mean, like, there are a lot of folks who will appropriate the Black Lives Matter slogan to say, not only all lives matter, but all animal lives matter. And, like, no one wants to be associated with those people. That's no good. Similarly, just because something doesn't have animal products in it does not mean that it is cruelty-free. You will see a lot of vegan food that is labeled cruelty-free. But a group that I really love called the Food Empowerment Project has spent years compiling a list of chocolate manufacturers and which ones use chocolate that was made by child slaves. And regardless of whether or not something has animal products in it, if it was made by human child slaves, it is probably should not be considered vegan, because there was a lot of suffering that went into it. And so I just think it's really important for folks who want to be a chill vegan to make sure that you are also concerned about the welfare of the human animals who are making your food and who are serving you in restaurants and who are just around you in everyday life. Because if you are not worried about the liberation and equity for humans, then you're like, humans are animals. They're human animals. And if you're not fighting for like $15 minimum wage, if you're not fighting for reparations, if you're not fighting for trans folks and queer folks and disabled folks, you can't be a good vegan. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way. I mean, there are vegans who will use PETA. PETA is a great example. PETA is so terrible. All of PETA's campaigns are either like fat phobic or extremely sexist or extremely racist. And that's not good. It's not good veganism. And I don't mean good veganism in like a purity way. I just mean like you're not being a good person. Like you're vegan, but you're not a good person. So, and there are people who will compare animal agriculture, like factory farming, to the Holocaust. And like, I don't care, or like slavery. And it's like, I don't care if that's how you feel personally. You can't, you don't, as white people, like as white vegans specifically, like you don't get to decide that you're going to compare factory farming to slavery because you didn't experience that. And that's hurtful for like actual descendants of slaves. Mm-hmm. And so, and again, you know, like, also just like the centering of white vegans at the expense of people of color whose cultures have had vegetarianism and veganism for centuries. But yeah, I just think it's really important to have a critical lens at vegan movements. And if they're not intersectional, then don't give them your money.
I love this particularly because I can like feel people getting defensive. There's like which is my favorite, right? Like it's great. Not that that's my goal, but you know, when you say things that are both true and challenging, it's just like very necessary to sit there and like, just like take that in. And I guess like, is even hearing that, this is like, I have this in my Instagram bio, 96% vegan. It's like kind of just like basically what that came from was, again, what we were talking about before, this idea that like words mean stuff, right? And when I started long distance backpacking, like I have a down sleeping bag. Like I would sometimes eat non-vegan things in trail towns, and not that it's like a perfection game and who can be the most perfect vegan, but to be like, okay, this is not a label that I feel comfortable just like using if it's not true all the time. And so even like now having a little bit of distance from like feeling vegan or like feeling like that's a big part of my identity, still like watching where and what you're saying, like, ooh, that kind of makes me feel defensive, or ooh, you're totally right about this. Or I don't know. It's just great. It's awesome to listen to.
Yeah, totally. And like, I want to say just to your 96% vegan point, like, I totally respect you like stepping away from the vegan label, but I think that vegan often gets into like purity politics of like who can be the most vegan, who can be like the level 9 vegan. And it's so important to emphasize that like veganism means doing your best, and doing your best is going to look different for different people at different times. And so maybe you do still have a down sleeping bag because like that's what you have, and like you can't afford to like buy the top notch best non-down vegan sleeping bag that will keep you just as warm as the down sleeping bag or whatever. And like, that's fine and legit. And like, any effort that people want to make towards veganism is better than nothing. Like, it really upsets me when people try to like out vegan each other and like disqualify, like, well, you're not a real vegan because you did this, and you're not a real vegan but did that. Like, the truth is, like, none of us are leading 100% pure vegan lives. We're all eating food that people were harmed in the production of the food that we're eating. We are all like, having electronic goods and transportation in which animals and humans were harmed in the production of those things. We're all probably using medications that were tested on animals. Even if you're avoiding, cosmetics that were tested on animals, you're probably going to take a medication at some point that was tested on animals. And the goal is to not like be 100% pure, holy being. the point is to like try to minimize suffering of humans and on human animals when you can. And when you can't, the goal is to like cut yourself a little bit of slack and be like, all right, I'm a human and I'm trying my best.
Yeah, I love that you said this. And okay, let me try to articulate my response because I don't know if this is something that I've ever really talked about before. But I think when you were saying like who can be the best vegan, right? Like the like mm-hmm. level 9 vegan or whatever. And I think this could be true for other labels other than just vegan or other movements. Mm-hmm. But that the sort of if perfection is the goal, I think that that's when the blinders come on, where folks aren't willing to look critically at all of the very necessary and intelligent points that you made earlier. Because anything that threatens your identity as the perfect mm-hmm. whatever, like if I'm really attached to being seen as like the perfect vegan, then I would find it very threatening for you to say, okay, well, what about this? Or what about the ways in which, you know, veganism isn't intersectional or any of these things? Because it's sort of like, as opposed to the goal of just continuing to try to do better and acknowledging where you are doing harm. And because like you said, we all are all the time, some more than others. But I know I think there's like some freedom and something necessary in that of like, if we can let go of needing to be the perfect whatever, then it lets you have more space to actually maybe be less perfect, but be more good. Does that make
sense? Totally. Yeah, it totally does. I mean, and that's literally like a line that I'm obsessed with. It's from East of Eden. That's literally the line is like, now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good or something like that. And it's really powerful and important. I mean, like I mentioned Food Empowerment Project and I talked to Lauren, who's the head of Food Empowerment Project one time. And I was like, look, like I don't eat animal products, but most fruits and vegetables are picked by underpaid workers. Like that's just like, even if I go to the farmer's market, I don't know who picks the food that I'm eating. I can't like grow all my own food. Is there literally any way that I can eat and be sure that like humans and non-humans have not suffered from my food? And she was like, no, there's not. You just have to try your best and advocate so that less harm is done in the future. And like that, I think that really like sunk in. Like there's nothing I can eat that is perfect. All I can do is try to do the best I can at any given time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like some of the problematic elements of veganism specifically sort of fall under the like larger cultural obsessions with health and wellness and the ways that that's problematic. And I don't even know what in there to talk about, but I know just like health and wellness specifically and sort of that obsession definitely intersects with other topics that you care about, that you write about, stuff that we've already talked about. Also just like eating disorders, body positivity, capitalism. I don't know like where in there there's something that maybe you would want to talk about, but I think that the role or like the way that veganism sort of falls under that health and wellness industry is like so problematic in so many ways that we certainly don't have like 19 hours to get into, but there's like something in there, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So as I mentioned, I edited the health section of a magazine for a while. And I eventually stopped. And this is something that I've talked to Lacey Davis about, as well as a few other like people who work in the health and wellness and fitness industry. And the reason that I stopped was because I stopped feeling comfortable advocating for health and wellness. And it's not that I don't want people to feel good in their bodies or good in their brains. But I have just been increasingly convinced that healthism is just our new beauty standard and our new personal value barometer. And more culturally, we have left the idea that you need to be, I don't know, super skinny, for example. But we have become obsessed with this concept of like being this peak physical specimen and being as fit as humanly possible, being as healthy as humanly possible. And, you know, maybe it's only eating whole plant-based foods, or maybe it's doing like these specific exercises every single day, or like doing this specific meditation work, or doing this specific like lemon water cleanse. And none of those things are necessarily bad in a vacuum, but when they become a measure of your self-worth, that's when it gets really dangerous. I mean, even in the worlds of like body positivity and fat positivity, there's this movement that's like, well, look, fat people can be healthy. And so it's okay to be fat as long as you're healthy. And it's like, no, it's just okay to be fat. It's just okay to be fat, period. You don't have to be healthy to be like a good fat person. You don't have to be healthy to be a good person. When we focus on health as a barometer of the value of someone, we alienate everyone who has a chronic illness and everyone who has a disability, and just say like, sorry, you can never be good because you can't participate in these like wellness regimes that we are now emphasizing as a culture. And I just think it's really, really dangerous because it seems healthy and good. Like, what could be better than health? But when we focus on health at the expense of like living a good, valuable, interesting life, that isn't healthy. And I know I just ranted for a long time, but I do want to share like my personal experience with that, yeah. Which is that I had an eating disorder. And I thought so much about my food all of the time, and I wanted it to be like the perfect food to eat. And like, I never ate anything processed, and I never ate anything that I thought was bad for me. And I also exercised a lot, and I had, a feeling where I sort of like always needed to be moving, and sitting still was inherently bad. And at this time in my life, just coincidentally or not, I was very depressed and I was very isolated. I was in an abusive relationship and I didn't really have a support system and I didn't really have anything else to do. And so what I did was I went to work and I went to yoga and I ran and I obsessed over my food. And that's what I thought about all the time. And I was like in pretty good shape, but I was very miserable. Mm-hmm. And over time, I got healthier and my eating disorder got better, but I still was exercising a lot because I didn't have anything else to do. And I was in great shape and I ran a really fast half marathon and people were really impressed. And then over the last year or two, I've made a ton of friends. I've made Gender Reveal the podcast. I started dating my partner about 2 years ago. We adopted a cool cat. And develop some other cool hobbies and interests and groups that we go to. And now, like, I don't go to yoga anymore. I, like, run much shorter distances. I don't think very hard about what I eat. Probably I still do compared to some people. But, like, for me, I don't think at all about what I eat. And I feel so much better because I get to do the things in my life that are really fun and fulfilling. Like, I get to make the podcast, and I get to talk to you, and I get to go travel, and I get to hang out with friends, and I get to sit still and watch TV for a while. And that feels so much better to me. But if you look at my life now through the rubric of health and wellness versus my life 2 years ago was much better because I was doing all these cool wellness things, mm-hmm. and I could run faster.
Yeah. Oh my God. There's so much in here that I think is necessary and also very, very relatable probably. I mean, for me, for a lot of people too, that like, it's the process of even letting go of the outward validation that comes from pursuing those health and wellness behaviors. Mm-hmm. That, like, that there's like a thing there, you know, like there's so much morality around health and the pursuit of health and that's what we're supposed to be doing. And if you're not doing that, it's like, I don't know, just, you like lose that privilege and validation.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so good. Before we start to wrap up, is there anything that hasn't come up yet in this discussion, either sort of like addendums to things that we've talked about or whole other topics that you're like, yes, I want to discuss that? Or any other stories you want to share, maybe?
I think I'm okay.
Like, I'm sure. Think we talked about everything.
It's like I could talk forever, but I don't think of any specific things that we haven't talked about. I think we're good.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I mean, and we covered a lot, and obviously you're always invited back if there's other things you want to talk about. But the way that we wrap up these episodes are with some hopefully fun, like rapid fiery questions. Basically, the folks who support the podcast on Patreon, for before every season, we do kind of like a little roundup of, oh, what are the questions that you would like me to ask all 8 guests this season? So I have 7 totally random questions that they put forward that everyone this season is answering, if you're down to answer some random questions.
Yeah, sounds great.
What is your favorite thing to eat for breakfast lately?
Oh gosh. I live in Portland, Oregon, and there is a like sort of secret vegan restaurant inside Big Pink downtown. And they make a veggie tofu scramble and then biscuits and gravy with tempeh on it. and then a berry almond butter protein smoothie, and I just grab all of that and like eat it at my desk for several hours, and it's amazing.
I want literally everything that you just mentioned. Well, yeah, I mean, and I'm in Bend. I don't know if you knew that, but where I'm in, like, come to Portland often, and mostly it's for eating. I mean, for friends too, but Bend does not have a great vegan food scene. It's definitely not the reason people live in Bend. And I'm always like, okay, I'm going to be here for 48 hours. How many different places can I go? For me, the breakfast is the tempeh pesto scramble at Harlow.
Yum. Yes, that's so one of my favorites also.
Okay, well, clearly I need to buy you breakfast at some point. What's the one thought that gives you the most butterflies right now? Like, when you think about it, you get all excited and tingly, maybe even a little bit nervous.
I don't get butterflies a lot because I'm really good at having depression, which steps on a lot of butterflies. But I have been talking with my friend Aubrey in New York about maybe doing a gender reveal live show. And that's very exciting to me. Or maybe it's not a live show. Maybe I'm just talking to her in New York. But anyway, doing some sort of gender event in New York seems very good.
That sounds awesome. What's one belief or opinion that you've totally done a 180 on? Something that you used to believe, but that you no longer do?
Hell yeah. I used to believe that some bodies were better than other bodies, and that being fat was inherently unhealthy or inherently bad or someone's choice or like the result of being lazy or all sorts of shitty toxic opinions. And then I found out that all bodies are chill, and that everyone's cool and chill, and being fat is chill, and like don't shame people for their bodies. And I love that. And I'm just so stoked that I don't have to try to be smaller all the time anymore, because it turns out that like people are allowed to take up as much space as they want to take up or do take up.
I think that we could all just like listen to that segment on repeat over and over again. That's so good. Also, I just want to say as a sidebar, I think that it's really helpful and necessary and important when people are willing to talk about their past problematic beliefs, right? Like nobody was formed with all like the correct opinions. I don't know. Just like hearing you say, hey, I used to believe that not all bodies were this the same, or that they were not all bodies were good bodies. I think that's true for literally everyone. That at some point that specific belief was the case. So anyway, thank you for saying that.
And I know this is rapid fire, but I do want to add like just something that I think it took me a long time to realize is like once I realized that diet culture existed, I was like, okay, so the solution is no one diets anymore. So I just have to convince people to stop dieting and it'll be fine. And it took me a while to be like, oh no, I need to convince people to stop shaming certain bodies, right? Like, because like you can't just be like, oh, we're all going to give you shit for living in that body, but don't try to diet. You know, like that's not fair.
Yeah.
So shifting my lens from like convincing people to not diet to like convincing society to stop creating a diet culture in which people feel pressured to diet was really important to me.
Yeah, so. Totally. Also, I need to come up with a better name for this segment because like the questions are short, but like the answers certainly don't have to be rapid.
Okay,
but yeah,
cool.
I mean, that's a topic that's come up in other episodes of the show too. This idea that like, of course, in, you know, when you're looking at any kind of oppression, like in an oppressive society, then wanting to take actions that are going to make you less subjected to that oppression. Like, of course that makes sense that like in a fat shaming culture, that being smaller would be a desirable thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. What's something that you are finding frustrating right now? Maybe like a particular thing or an area of your life that it feels really challenging?
Have you talked about spoon theory on the show?
No, and I don't even know what that is. So go for it.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Did I just break your brain?
Didn't realize that I needed to explain this. Okay. So spoon theory,
Google's free as fuck. I know. Yeah.
No, it's fine. Spoon theory, has to do with chronic illness, both like physical and mental illness. And, spoons, it's like a whole, yes, it's a whole thing that people can Google and read, and it might be valuable for people to Google and read. But, the concept of it on a basic level is like everyone is given a certain amount of spoons. And that can be translated to like energy or almost like fucks to give. And so like, if you have a lot of, chronic illness or fatigue or disability, it could, maybe you only have 3 spoons for the day, and it takes a spoon to take a shower and a spoon to make breakfast and a spoon to get out of bed and feed your cat. And then that's like all the spoons you have, and you can't do anything else because you're like tired and spent and you don't have any energy for anything else. So maybe you don't take a shower. Maybe you skip the shower and you do something else because you only have 3 spoons that day. So anyway, the thing that I'm frustrated with is that I don't have that many spoons, especially not right now. And not for like a
specific reason. I'm just like not doing super good right now. And there's so much that I want to do. And I feel like it's hard for me to do it because I don't have enough spoons. I don't have enough energy. I don't have enough like mental and physical and emotional bandwidth to do all of the things that I want to do. And it sucks sometimes. Like I was tweeting the other day, like, can you imagine how rad I would be if I actually just had energy and emotional stability, you know, and like mm-hmm. mental health. Like that would be so cool. And like my partner has like seemingly infinite spoons. And I don't even realize like that's even possible until I see him just be able to do things. And like, he'll say that. So I was like talking to him and I was like, hey, like, he was like, hey, do you want me to do the dishes? And I was like, no, it's my turn to do the dishes. I'll do them. And he's like, yeah, but like I have more spoons than you and I'm offering to do it. So do you want me to do it? And I was like, yes, that would be amazing. Thank you so much. So, so the frustrating thing is realizing that I have fewer spoons than other people, and there are people who are inherently going to be able to do more than I can on any given day because they just physically and mentally and emotionally can.
So I can't believe, my mind is like blown that I haven't heard of this spoon theory before, especially as someone with a mood disorder, like with mental illness. Like what you just described is like the perfect way to describe what being in a depressive episode feels like. Like there just aren't enough spoons. So as I'm listening to you talk, I'm like, oh my God, they get me. So that was awesome. I'm clearly gonna Google that myself. That's awesome. Not that you feel that way, but that you introduced that term to, I'm sure if it's new to me, it's new to other people too. What's something that you consider worth splurging on?
Oh gosh. I think supporting companies or individuals who I feel like are doing important work or whose values align with my values or who are traditionally marginalized folks, who I want to support, I think that's always worth splurging on. So, like my partner's like very cool, He is very cool. That wasn't supposed to be the end of the sentence, but he is very cool. He is like very into union organizing and like just thoughts about alternatives to capitalism. And so like he sort of talked me into joining the co-op. And like a co-op is a very basic thing, but thinking about the fact that like my money is going to like this cool group of local people who care a lot about sustainability and good politics and supporting trans folks and not buying chocolate that comes from slavery is really cool. And I am happy to give them an extra like 50 cents every time I buy something to know that my money is going to them and not, you know, the Whole Foods down the street, which means I'm giving money to Jeff Bezos. And like, I don't need to give money to Jeff Bezos. He has enough money.
This is not one of the list of questions, but since you've mentioned chocolate a couple of different times, do you have a favorite vegan, like non-slavery chocolate that you can recommend?
Oh gosh. I mean, I have a lot. I do recommend there's a Food Empowerment Project app that has pretty much every chocolate in there. And there's a ton of chocolate that are on the approved slavery-free list. And so it doesn't hurt to just like, if you're standing at that huge wall of chocolate in any store and you can't decide, it doesn't hurt to like pull out the list and be like, well, let's narrow it down to the ones that aren't using child slavery. But let's see. I really like Theo, which is based out of Seattle, is it? Anyway, Washington. Anyway, I like Theo. There's some other ones.
Yeah, I like that too. Also, I'm definitely going to download that app. That's awesome. So the next question is about books. Which two or three books, any type of book, any genre, would you say have either had the biggest impact on you or that you recommend or reread most often?
I am a millennial, so Harry Potter was very important to me. But right now, I mean, I think that All About Love, New Visions by Bell Hooks is a book that every single person should read. I found that it might make you realize that maybe no one's ever loved you, but somehow that's like a productive thing to learn. I don't know. I think it's really, really valuable and really necessary for like literally every person. Let's see. I'm like literally looking around my house trying to look for books. I don't know. I don't know what else.
I mean, if nothing else comes to mind, then I feel like whatever comes up is always, you know, the answer to give.
Yeah. No, I think that's it.
So the last question, if you could leave our community, the listeners, with one call to action, what would it be? Maybe a question to ask themselves or a small action to take?
Oh, goodness. I think that it's really important to try to remind yourself that most people are doing their best
at any given time. And I don't know. I mean, like, there are situations in which I don't have the energy to manage people's feelings, but I think a lot of times, like, when there are people who are being really frustrating or are behaving in a way that you wish they wouldn't behave, or maybe did something that was hurtful to you, I think remembering that, like, everyone is doing the best they can, and most people's behaviors aren't a reflection on you, it's a reflection on them and the specific circumstances they're finding themselves in and all of the things that have led up to that moment, can be really helpful in finding extra compassion for people. It's really easy for me to get frustrated when people don't do exactly what I want them to do. And then I remember that it's not about me. Mm-hmm. It's about them and, like, their whole lives and their whole experiences. And, like, of course they're not going to do exactly what I want to do, because, like, they're them, they're their own person doing their own life, and they're just trying to do the best they can for themselves, and for other people. And I guess that's just what I would encourage other people to think about as well.
Yeah, I love that. What's the best place for people to find you and say hi online? Do you have a favorite way to connect with new folks?
Not really a favorite. It's sort of whatever people want to do. Obviously, my podcast, Genderveal, is in iTunes and Stitcher and all the other podcast places. Wherever they're listening to this, you can probably find me. I'm on Twitter at Molly Woodstock, and also at Genderveal, which is GenderEVEAL. There's only one R in there. And I'm also on Instagram at molly.woodstock. Don't try to friend me on Facebook if I don't know you. But Twitter and Instagram is good, and the podcast is good.
Awesome. Well, I will put links to those things in the show notes. I also just wanted to shout out that you use Patreon as well. And as I was making my list of action steps today, and I was like, okay, go join their Patreon. Because when were talking about what's worth splurging on and putting your money there, it's been wild how becoming a creator on Patreon and thinking in this sort of, how can we pay creative people directly for their work or their activism or, you know, all of that kind of stuff, has really changed how I'm allocating kind of my own budget. I'm like, well, I have been getting so much value from your podcast, so I'm going to pay for it. Oh. And so just wanted to shout out that you also use Patreon.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I also, like, do like to emphasize that, like, I would really like this content to be free for trans listeners. And so if straight and cis people are willing to donate money, that's really important, because just statistically, straight people and especially cis people will statistically have exponentially more wealth and access to employment than trans people. And so, yeah, if cis people are willing to donate to the show, it means that trans people can listen for free, which is great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I like that you specifically call that out on your Patreon page. And I think, I don't remember the words you use, but that if you are someone who's using this as an educational tool, so basically like someone like me who's using mm-hmm. it and learning a ton from it, then there's even more reason to be the one who's paying for that tool.
Yeah, exactly. Because the show does exist for two reasons. And one is an educational tool for cis people. And one is like a place for trans and non-binary and queer people to see each other and feel represented. And I don't want to charge them for that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's so well said. Awesome. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to speak with you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening and for being part of the Real Talk Radio family. Speaking of the Real Talk Radio family, I wanted to give a huge shout out to Adam Day, my producer and sound engineer. Adam created the music for this show, and he makes everything work and flow and sound way better than I ever could on my own. You can find him and his music and his sound editing work at adamday.net. And as I said way back at the top of the episode, this is a 100% listener-supported show. The show is made possible by awesome people like Chelsea. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi.
You ready to answer some rapid-fire questions?
As ready as I'll ever be.
I guess so. What are you totally obsessed with right now?
Boy bands.
Anyone in particular? That's a fun answer.
Sort of boy bands generally, but I feel pretty strongly about One Direction and Harry Styles.
Okay. I mean, that you are not the only one. That is not a unique obsession. I like it. It's fun. If you could go back 5 years and give your younger self a piece of advice, what would it be?
Making a choice is usually more important than what you end up choosing. You just have to choose something.
Ooh, now I want to ask you like 1,000 more questions about that, but I will let that be. That's really good. Also, you know what I've been thinking about recently? The not making a choice is also a choice, you know? So it's like the more I put things off and I'm like, that's a choice too. Like I actually could just be more proactive.
Yeah, no, that's true.
When or in what situation do you feel most yourself? Like when you're totally in your zone, being your truest self, what are you doing?
When I'm doing things that have got me like totally engaged. So something that I do by myself that happens sometimes is writing. Or being like at a concert in a crowd full of people and you're all sort of like having that moment engaging with the music, that I feel super like myself because I'm just there being.
So if you get to go to your favorite boy band concert, then that will be your peak self moment. what's one new thing that you would love to try this year?
Boxing.
Oh, just like competitively, like a fitness, like what do you mean?
Yeah, for fitness, I know someone who got super into boxing and is like, everyone should do boxing. And, I'm sort of interested in trying to find ways that feel good to move my body. And so I'm interested in seeing if maybe boxing is one of those things.
Nice. I love it. Last question. What's one thing that you recently have been wishing that people were more open and honest about? What do you find yourself curious about?
The things that they want in like an obsessive way, like the things that feel scary to say, like, I want that thing.
What do you mean?
Like the things that it sort of feels like a crazy person to want that you just like think over and over again about wanting those things. Like I want to know what those things are for different people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that I have things like that and I would like to believe that I'm not the only one that has those things. So like I want to know what it is that other people sort of want in this obsessive way that feels like you can't talk about it or that people will think that you are out of your mind. Basically, that's what I want.
All right. All right. Yeah. I like it. So you're a member of our Patreon support squad, which means that you're one of the people that listeners can thank for making this podcast possible, since you make a powerful reoccurring pledge that helps to fund the costs of producing the show each season, for which I am very grateful. And I would love for you to share maybe why you decided to support the show or your favorite thing about supporting the show, anything that you want to talk about like that.
One of the major reasons that made me decide to join the Patreon community was for your Notes of Grit and Grace. I love getting those emails, and I wanted to keep getting them, and so that was one of the big factors. And I love the podcast, and so between wanting to keep getting your emails and wanting to see the podcast continue to exist, it sort of made perfect sense that I'd give you my money.
I love when people love the emails because I have someone there. It's like, I feel like it's such a selfish thing because it's like a grounding practice for me every week. For whatever reason, I don't keep up with a journal. Like I need to know that other people's eyeballs are going to be on this thing. That's like what makes me write it. And yet for me, it feels this like very cathartic, helpful. Like I love, it's like a weekly ritual that I love. And so it always, I find it delightful when other people like get something from it too.
Yeah, it's my favorite way to start a Friday.
Oh, I love it. So good. That means a lot to me. And to everyone listening, if you love the podcast, if you want to help keep it going, if you want over 40 hours of bonus content, plus lots of other fun opportunities and extras, just go to patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette to make your pledge of $8 or more for each 8-episode season. I can't tell you how much your support means to me, and it'll be so much fun to get to know you better after you've joined our community. Maybe we can even record a future outro together like this one. So until next time, here's a big virtual hug and a reminder that we're all just doing the best we can, and no matter what, we're in this together.